does it feel to fly a Spitfire? How does it feel to take to the air and face a deadly enemy day after day?
I realized it at the time, and I can confirm it now, that I'd reached the pinnacle of my life, and nothing would replace being in a fighter squadron for 1940, 1941 and 1942, and it never did.
It is almost like the Spitfire knows what you want it to do. It takes the lightest of touch for it to respond to every input that you make. It does feel almost like you've grown wings.
This is Spitfire, the people's plane. The story of the men and women who designed, built and flew the beautiful plane that changed the course of the Second World War. Through this series, we've looked at the Spitfire from every angle. We've built it with the workers of Southampton and Birmingham. We've met the women who delivered the planes to the waiting air bases. And we've watched from below as it shot German bombers from the sky. But what is it actually like to fly the fastest and deadliest fighter of its day? As a teenage pilot, what does it feel like to train your guns on a Messerschmitt 109 determined to kill you before you kill them? Pull the canopy shut and start the Merlin engine. I'm Tuppence Middleton, and in this episode, we're taking to the air with two pilots, 80 years apart. Two pilots who adore the Spitfire.
Inside the cockpit where we are now then, they all smell the same. A delicious mixture, I guess, of paint thinners, fuel and what have you. But it's the first thing really that kind of hits you when you get into these aircraft.
This is Squadron Leader Mark Sugden. For most of the year, he flies a modern military jet, the Eurofighter Typhoon, for the Royal Air Force. He's flown in combat over Syria and Iraq, but each summer he leaves the high-tech world of modern warfare behind to fly a Spitfire for the Battle of Britain Memorial flight.
It is so beautifully designed, even by today's standards. The controls are so beautifully harmonised, and she's almost viceless in the air.
And this is Geoffrey Wellham. He flew a Spitfire against German bombers and fighters throughout the Battle of Britain.
People say to me, how do you remember these things? How do you expect me to forget? You don't. Can't. I remember it vividly, you know. It's a question of remembering. You can see it, see things, see people, see aeroplanes. The experiences of being a Spitfire fighter pilot in the Battle of Britain stay with you forever, and you can't do anything about it.
Geoff joined the Royal Air Force just weeks before the Second World War began.
I am 17 and a half years old, and I suspect a rather precocious young man. It was some 6 months ago when I first wrote to the Air Ministry. I was leaving school within a year and very much wanted to fly an aeroplane, so could they give me a job, please? It must have been a frightening prospect, because they certainly took their time replying. But eventually I received a response in the guise of an enormous and rather complicated form, together with a covering letter.
It was August 1939 when Geoff was accepted for initial training with the Royal Air Force. He flew his first solo flight in a Tiger Moth biplane on the day that Britain declared war with Germany. Training was fast and ruthless. It had to be. Geoff and his fellow trainees were pushed to the limit. Some died in flying accidents. Others were sent home, labelled as temperamentally unsuitable for combat. As Geoff trained, Hitler's forces crushed Poland and rolled through Holland, Belgium and France until they reached the English Channel.
The news from France is very bad, and I grieve for the gallant French people who have fallen into this terrible misfortune.
In June 1940, with no combat training, having never flown a modern fighter aircraft, Geoffrey Wellham is assigned to a newly formed Spitfire squadron at Duxford, near Cambridge. As his new comrades of 92 Squadron fly off to protect the British and French troops trapped on the beaches of Dunkirk, Geoff gets his first taste of a Spitfire.
Spitfire K for King stands waiting. The narrow legs of its undercarriage give it an almost delicate appearance. It has the air of a thoroughbred horse watching the approach of a new and unknown rider and wondering just how far to try it on and generally be bloody-minded. To fly a Spitfire. Think of the hundreds of pilots all over the service who would give their right arms to have this opportunity. To be a Spitfire pilot.
Once the formation's ready to start, I will be pressing the start buttons, which you can see just to the right-hand side underneath the instrument panel, flicking on the magnetos, and then I'll be waiting for the engine to start. The first thing we do is push forward on the stick, believe it or not. So when we add power, the effects of the propeller around the fuselage, that will drive the aircraft to the left. So when we start introducing power, we need to put right rudder to keep the aircraft running straight. We will then move the stick forward to try and get the tail off the ground. And the reason for that is it allows the aircraft to accelerate quicker, but it also affords me a view over the nose. So we'll bring the aircraft more up into a level attitude. Once I've got flying speed, I'll then be pulling gently back on the control column to get her airborne, raising the undercarriage, and then I'm away. That's where the fun starts.
Looking out of the tiny cockpit, I experience an exhilaration that I cannot recall ever having felt before. It's one of those wonderful dreams, a Peter Pan sort of dream. What a pity that an aeroplane that can impart such a glorious feeling of sheer joy and beauty has got to be used to fight somebody.
After Dunkirk, the intensity of the battle eases. Jeff has a chance to get to grips with his Spitfire. In the daylight, the plane handles beautifully, but he has to learn to fly it at night. That's not something the Spitfire is designed for.
Look out of the cockpit for the final landing, and the friendly line of flares has vanished. There is absolutely nothing to see but a jet-black void. A blinding flash and a noise of tearing and tortured metal.
Jeff's Spitfire hits a landing light and his left wing is ripped off. His commanding officer is furious and Jeff's grounded. By now, though, the Battle of Britain is underway. Hitler is set on a summer invasion, but to cross the English Channel, he needs control of the air over southern England. German bombers begin targeted attacks on ports, airfields and factories. 92 Squadron is transferred to Biggin Hill in Kent, right on the front line. Despite his commanding officer's displeasure, Geoffrey Wellham is needed for combat duty.
I personally used to walk out to my aeroplane first light. There were the ghostly images and of the Spitfires and people working on them. And you walk out with your parachute on your shoulder and across the grass and You'd notice things like dew on the glass. It'd been a lovely night, going to be a gorgeous day, and you'd probably sling up a little prayer or something, and you wouldn't tell anybody else about it.
It is first light and still and rather beautiful, the birth of a new day. Reveries are suddenly and rudely broken.
Yes?
Squadron scramble.
One after the other, Spitfires are starting up. 12 Merlins, all at 1,200 revs or thereabouts. The power of the moment is awe-inspiring. The still morning air reverberates with the sound of harnessed energy. Slipstreams flatten the grass behind the quivering aircraft. In its way, it is exciting, wonderful, and not without a certain beauty. It is also tragic. Which of us is going to be killed this day?
Radar picks up a formation of enemy aircraft approaching the Kent coast at Dungeness. Plotters guide the 10 Spitfires of 92 Squadron toward 150 German aircraft, bombers protected by Messerschmitt 109s, fighter planes every bit as fast and deadly as the Spitfire.
To be in this aeroplane with just one or two others and go into 150 plus, all bombers, and like a lot of gnats on a summer evening.
Jeff catches sight of a Heinkel 111 bomber separated from the protection of his formation. He fires his six Browning machine guns until he's out of ammunition and the smouldering bomber is spiraling towards the waves.
If you stayed still, if you flew straight and level for 20 seconds, you were dead. Never stay still. If you can't see anything, it's always the chap you didn't see who shot you down.
Suddenly there's a flash and something flaming red streaks past the cockpit.
More explosions behind me. A frightening noise I can't place as more tracers go tearing past. It is only a fraction of a second before it registers, but even that delay is too long. I've been hit. I've behaved like a beginner, bounced from behind. I instinctively duck and at the same time yank the Spitfire round in the tightest and roughest turn ever. Looking back over my shoulder, an ME-109 is sitting on my tail not 30 yards away. I see the flash from his cannons and puffs of greyish smoke as he tries a quick burst. Not a bad one either, as I hear more hits somewhere behind down the fuselage. I hear myself say, strangely enough, in a normal voice, "Oh God, I'm going to be killed." I keep turning, keep going, and the 109 tucks behind me in a very determined manner. Still tighter with the turn, if possible, Jeff. I start to black out. Must be pulling 6G. Mustn't go black if I can help it. I can see his head quite clearly, and even the dark shape of his oxygen mask. I imagine that the 109 gives a distinct flick on the point of a high-speed stall. He has to ease his turn a fraction. The Spitfire gains a fraction.
When that 109 caught me off that Heikel, I remember thinking, if you get away with this, you'll get away with anything. Because he should have killed me.
The boys were literally pulling the aircraft, which is structurally very, very strong, to a point where, you know, they would almost black out because under, you know, high levels of positive G, the blood is moved away from your head and down to your feet, which means that when your eyes and your brain are starved of blood, potentially you can even lose consciousness. And if you read the books of the guys who are out there fighting over the Channel in the Battle of Britain, you know, they would routinely be pulling to the levels where they lost their vision or blacked out entirely.
There were times when the end of the day, in the evening, and you were probably coming back to Big and having survived, you felt a presence of an unknown being. Only pilots know it. You're flying alone, you know, and the beauty of the sun going down and all the rest of it, and you feel a presence of well-being, of peace, and then you'll feel a wonderful sense of loneliness. Of peace and loneliness, and as if there's an unknown being somewhere around about.
There was a huge amount of fear that went with it, and it was very much in the face of the enemy. I mean, to put it in comparison with the Typhoon now, the weapons that we have, they give you a lot of standoff, we call it. You know, we would be engaging aircraft before I can even see them. This is very much eye to eye, toe to toe. Pilots routinely crash landing, bailing out. You know, the fear of burning in these aeroplanes is something that a lot of them do talk about, and I can really get a sense of that. You know, the smell of these aircraft, when you get in them, you can smell the fumes, the petrol. You're acutely aware that you're surrounded by high-octane fuel, and I think a lot of them, the fear of the horrendous burns that a lot of the pilots had when they had been shot down, you know, I don't think you'd be human if you didn't have that awareness and be fearful of it when you did take them flying. And for that, I take my hat off to all of them.
Fear and boredom. Day after day, the same routine. Take off at first light, engage and kill the enemy. Back to base to refuel and rearm. Mugs of tea as you wait, exhausted, to see how many of your comrades make it back alive. The stress builds and intensifies. The skies clear over Britain. Nearly 2,000 German aircraft have been destroyed. The British have lost 1,200 fighters. Jeff and his Spitfire are sent to the island of Malta to help protect the Mediterranean shipping lanes. It's one mission too many for the exhausted fighter ace.
I had a breakdown. I think they call it combat fatigue at the moment.
and I had a very acute sinus, which was very painful, and I had quite a nasty operation there, and everything just went, whoa. And then you've had that horrible feeling that you weren't pulling your weight. But they put me on an aeroplane, sent me back to England, gave me a month's leave.
Geoffrey Wellham, a hero, battered and broken, is just 20 years old.
I am exhausted, both mentally and physically. I had no reserves left. I was sent home on sick leave, and there was my room waiting for me, just as I had left it over 3 years ago. Something inside me gave way, and I stretched out on the same familiar comfy bed and broke down. I grieved for my lost friends. 2 full tours on Spitfires, the Battle of Britain, and nearly 100 escorts and fighter sweeps over occupied France, and I felt destroyed by the war.
Nobody wants a medal. I think the thing that we want is to be remembered, because that takes in all the people who were shot down and didn't get a medal and deserved it. We're not heroes. Don't give us medals. Just remember us. That's all.
In most lives, I suppose, there comes a time when one has to make a supreme effort that calls for every morsel of endeavour, and more often than not, that effort has to be sustained. With me, I'm certain that my time came with my 3 years as a Spitfire pilot in our country's finest hour. My only regret is that it had to happen so early in my life. But there it is.
Geoffrey was the youngest Spitfire pilot to survive the war. Many years later, he wrote his best-selling memoirs, First Light. He died in 2018. Nothing in his life ever compared with that desperate, deadly summer as a teenage Spitfire pilot. In the next and final episode of Spitfire, The People's Plane, we join the plotters, the women who guided Spitfires to their targets on the longest, toughest day of the Battle of Britain, the day which would decide everything.
Hi, I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and I'm the host of The Comb from the BBC World Service.
This is The Comb.
You need The Comb.
The Comb now.
Need The Comb.
The Comb.
The Comb is a weekly podcast that unpicks one single African story every week.
Why am I different?
What is it that drives me? What is my passion?
I am a hustler. I hustle.
It has been a big eye-opener.
The name, The Comb, is because we are combing through the continent for stories that matter.
I just thought, what in the world?
I actually got emotional about it.
I cried a lot.
So here's the thing about The Comb. What we really want to do is to get our listeners involved, to put our listeners right at the center of the podcast, to have them tell us about the stories that they are interested in, the stories that are affecting their lives. And then we can use the journalism of the BBC Africa newsroom to investigate and to look into those stories. That's The Comb from the BBC World Service. Just search for The Comb wherever you get your podcasts.